Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this December the 11th on the West Coast, now December the 12th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. It's so nice to have you with us. I should say, Guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren, for Seth. Seth wants to learn to speak a little German. So if you speak German when you call in with a question or a comment, make sure you teach Seth a little bit of German. That's going to be fun for him. We'd like to welcome everyone listening on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, as well as on blogtalkradio.com on the Internet. Well, lots going on. The long-legged Mac Daddy went to Oslo, made a speech, got his $1.4 million for the Nobel Peace Prize, or as we called it when we first heard about this, the weekend of October, I think it was around October the 10th, somewhere around there, or the 9th when it was announced. I called it eventually the Nobel Peppers Pizza Surprise. And that's about what it's worth, to tell you the truth. As the war in Afghanistan is being ramped up, and they have plans to send another 30,000 troops. For what reason, I don't know, unless they need more people picking the poppies. I had an earlier conversation with tonight's guest, and I kind of made a comment that I should allow him to be on the show when I make it. So he can defend himself. Our guest tonight is a regular Friday night guest. You can tell I'm in a crazy mood. I've been doing research all day and writing, and we may talk about that as well. He is a scientist, inventor, lecturer, author, and teacher, and not necessarily in that order. And he's our resident science advisor here on Evident Footprints. He's been on the show now for over 2.5 years with me every week, and his name is Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show once again.
Yes, Don, thank you. As usual, it's great to be with you.
Well, I was talking about what was going on in Afghanistan, what the plans are to send all these troops over there, and I was thinking about the ridiculous nature of the boogeyman that they had a few years back, the guy that died in December of 2001 that they keep bringing forward every couple of months. You remember Osama bin Laden. And I had made kind of an interesting observation. You know, we have this name Obama, and then we have this name Osama. And they're very similar, and I've accidentally interchanged them, and I guess it doesn't really matter, because they're just made up names anyway. But if you take the letters that are different from Osama and from Obama, or Obama and Osama, you have a B and an S. And if you put them together, you have BS. And that's what I wanted to say about those two names.
Only you could find that needle in a haystack.
And only I could do that, right. I'm sure there's probably been someone else somewhere on the earth that's thought of that. Maybe not on a radio show.
But well, the interesting thing is that it certainly is, it's an adequate application of those initials. There's no question about that part.
Well, when I was Seth, if you're listening, I've got a little bit of echo here. Okay, it seems like that stopped it. When I was doing my research, today in sorting out a tremendous amount of obfuscation in records, you know, traveling records of people entering and leaving the country and that. And it gets pretty confusing when every time a person arrives at a port, they have a different story. They have a different age, and people normally progress. You know, this year a person will be one age, and next year they'll be a year older. How someone can jump through a period of 12 years and only have aged 10 during that time is beside me. Or, likewise, progress 10 years ahead into the future and be 12 years older. These are the types of records that our government is holding, and it shows a tremendous amount of not just corruption, but ignorance or just pure evil and deceit. That these things would be put into writing and are available for people to look at, and people don't see them. Now, I've been studying genealogies, which is kind of how you figure out who somebody is, and I can tell you who certain people are not on the basis of what I've discovered. But, I mean, look at me. I come on the show and I start speaking German, you know. it's like I've been in a time warp or something. And when you come out of it, none of it makes any sense because it's all lies. So we have something, we have a very interesting piece coming out. I'm hoping to have this thing totally wrapped up sometime tomorrow and put up on my website. And it's the follow-up to the Eisenhower piece that I did less than 2 weeks ago, actually. And thousands of people have read that article, and it's pretty much all over the Internet now. And this one, I think, is much, much more thorough. And the research that went behind the first article actually all transpired in one day, the research and the article, everything. Now, I've spent a solid week following up on things that I caught the first go-around, and some people are going to be very, very surprised how this stuff stands up to scrutiny. So if you'd like to comment on that, you're welcome to.
Well, as we were discussing in our conversation earlier today, quite honestly, I've reached a plateau now where nothing surprises me anymore. I mean, it's a shame in a way because a lot of these things become violations of my earlier understanding of our nation and the concepts that we held dear at one point. You know, all of that began to shatter for me quite some time ago. I would say mostly around the time of the Kennedy assassination when I started getting interested in all this stuff and wondering what was really going on and started some research of my own. And I quickly realized that all is not as it seems. And then, of course, once you start digging, you start finding out things. I mean, the next illusion that I had shattered was the original image that I had of Abraham Lincoln. And Eisenhower, I mean, my dad was in World War II and spoke very highly of Ike. And I was exposed to a lot of that as a kid. And you know, you form an impression, you have a feeling about, you know, some of these people, and it's a little bit disquieting to find out that they're nothing like the way you imagined them. But I think the real problem is that you reach a point where it's no longer a surprise because you're already assuming that everything's a lie. It's just a shame that reality doesn't gel or jive with, you know, your earlier notions of things held dear and your earlier understanding of the nation that you live in. But despite that discomfort, I think it makes a lot of sense that we shed what is not true and beat the bushes to find the truth, because in the long run, that's the only thing that's going to sustain us. And my hat's off to you for the work you're doing in that direction.
Well, you know, it's this got started by somebody sending me a very real article, which told the story of a birth certificate snafu back in 1952. And I read the article. First of all, the story itself sort of jumps out at you because of what's going on currently. And, you know, they're coming up with these terms. Everybody who has something to say about 9/11 is being called a truther. And everybody who has something to say about Obama's lack of any documentation whatsoever is being called a birther, as if somehow that puts us in a place that ridicules us, that nips it in the bud. End of discussion. And
What do they call someone who has something to say about both of those topics? A true birther?
Well, they're calling people who were complaining about this issue of Obama's birth certificate and documentation and college records and the whole nine yards, they're calling them birthers. I mean,
no, I was trying to make a joke.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand you.
Yeah,
again.
I was saying that what do they call someone who has a negative comment about both those subjects? You know, 9/11 and the lack of records. You know, have to come up with a name for that also.
Well, I suppose, or they just lumped the two names together. I mean, I'll probably come up with one, but I certainly came up with an interesting title for this article, which really explains it, and that sort of puts it in a very associative mode that people will understand what it means right away. And, you know, without giving away the title, I just have to say that what I've discovered and what the pieces of the puzzle that I put together, I've gone over and over and over many times to be absolutely certain. And the one thing I have to keep reminding myself is these things that are written down are not true. These are total lies. I've disproven them. You'll see the examples. I mean, addresses that are impossible in some of the towns that are described. Situations that are alleged to be real as someone's entering the country, not only to find out that they're lying, but the probability of that even being remotely true is zero. And yet these people are allowed in the country. Well, they described how they were going to do this in the protocols of the elders of Zion when they said that they were going to bribe people in the government. They were going to bribe officials and get them to do their bidding. And we were going to be stupid and ignorant of what was going on. It's going to be alarming and very convincing at the same time. And I certainly hope that it has an impact and wakes some people up. I really do. Because this goes further back in our history right now. And people say, well, what does it have to do with what's going on today? Has everything to do, you see, because when you have people who enter this country illegally, allowed to take the reins of the presidency of the United States, the laws are null and void. Really, you just take the books and burn them. And start over and get rid of the bums that created all this mess. That's the bottom line. I don't know how else to say it without beating around the bush, to use your term. So.
Well, I think that it needs to be said. And, of course, one of our objectives has always been to wake people up and point these things out. But you made a comment there during your little soliloquy that I thought was interesting about the fact that they invent these names. You know, they like to categorize everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's something that feels very unnatural about pigeonholing information. I mean, I don't know exactly how to get a hook into it, but it seems to me to be absolutely opposite of the more widely accepted way of doing things, which is just to have a complete overview of everything that's going on and just try to assimilate it holistically. Why do you suppose they like to stick everything in little cubby holes? You know, the only thing I can think of is that it's just another way of dividing people up. You know, once they give people these titles, there's no reason why they can't take the next step and actually, you know, pit the birthers against the truthers. You know, and mm-hmm. the resulting commotion causes more distraction. I mean, it just, I don't know, it seems to me, I'm not a psychologist, but it seems to me that there's a method to that madness. It isn't just a question of giving different groups different names for no particular reason. But what's your take on that?
Well, they're very ritualistic. In fact, I write about this in the article, so I don't want to give it all away. But to be blunt, they're ritualistic in what they do. They like putting it out there in front of your face to sort of see if we pick up the clues, see if we're sufficiently dumbed down to where they can do this out in the open and we don't react to it or we don't say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. Okay, that's occurring right now. I mean, it's not just me. There are many people that are really going down the rabbit hole, so to speak, and digging up the truth. And we all have our own perspective of what the truth is. And when you're talking about history and you look at the billions and billions and billions of dollars that have been invested in textbooks in schools, your pet peeve is the disinformation in the scientific world, or the cockeyed or cockamamie theories that they present that hold no foundation in the truth whatsoever. Yet they're blindly accepted by scientists, and so you have this stagnation of progress, and you have this stagnation of intelligence and consciousness, if there is any remaining consciousness. And they like to flaunt this. They like to flaunt their little, they're really quite infantile in how they rule and how they make the rules and how they act when they're exposed for the frauds that they are, the charlatans that they are. And what do they do? They don't take care of the murder that they commit themselves. They have someone else do the bidding, you see. They're so, what's the word I want to use? Psychopathic about control. That they have to have someone else do it. That they have to even be in power in coming to those decisions, that they're going to get rid of somebody because they're tired of the public hearing the truth. And that's fear-based, you see. And so they're not as great and grand as they think they are. So they make these really stupid decisions. Certainly, if you're going to try to fool the world, you could come up with a smarter way to do it than falsify records that people can read. Of course, they withhold a lot of information from us, but why do they do that? We can immediately deduce that they're hiding their corruption. And that's the case right now when they won't answer where the bailout money goes. They're corrupt. They don't want you to know the truth that they're stealing trillions of dollars. So, and really, they have no money. They have no money to bail anything out. They've been bankrupt since 1933. They've just been faking the whole thing to get us to be productive, you see? To make us work, to make us think that we're earning a living. So that's sort of the answer in the nutshell. Jim, we have a call, if you'd like to take a question.
Well, as long as it's something I can answer, I'll always take the question.
Okay, Noella, are you with us?
And I love the topic about people can't see things right under their very noses. That's why I'm calling, just to tell you what we've noticed downtown near our parliament buildings, where basically it would be like your White House, okay?
Where are you calling from, Noella, for the listeners?
I'm calling from Ottawa, Canada.
Okay, how are you this evening?
Good, good. Wide awake.
Wide awake, okay.
In many ways, yeah. Don't worry, they're slowly getting awake, but I agree with you, not fast enough. One thing I wanted to just find out, if Jim might know the significance in history, but, well, Dr. Holmes has a show on Zero Point, and I met him, and we sort of joined a CAT, which is a Party for Action for Truth. It's total volunteer, no money involved, just people like regular folks going out on the street trying to find out what's really going on in the world. So one of the things, there's so many things, but this one interested me. What does the significance of a giant, probably 40-foot, iron-made Black Widow spider right downtown near the Parliament buildings with a bunch of eggs? You can see these white eggs, maybe they're plastic or styrofoam, stuck in the belly of it, ready to burst. And Dr. Holmes is researching this monument, and he says they had one in Nazi Germany like that. So I'll take your answer off the phone, but I don't know if you guys are aware of that, but these little giant monuments of Black Widow spiders ready to burst eggs seem to be cropping up as art forms downtown. Like, it's an ugly art form. And I don't know the significance, but it just struck me odd. So I just wanted to hear what you would think of that.
I'm wondering if the eggs fell off of Michelle Obama's dress when she wore.
I don't know. I was going to tease you and say they're white eggs, but I don't know. I'm just teasing. There's nothing, no prejudice intended. But
no,
anyway,
spider eggs tend to be white anyway. They wrap up in silk a little bit.
What's the difference, eh? Color, yeah. It's not about the color. It's what's underneath there that worries me.
Well, Jim, do you want to answer that?
And I'll take it off air, Don. Okay? And thank you both. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. You want to respond to that, Jim?
It's a shame she left so fast. I was going to ask her something, too. But anyway, with regard to the spider, I'm not aware, of any historical significance of it that I can think of off the top of my head. I wouldn't be surprised if you were. But intuitively, there's a message there. And in my opinion, it's what the spiders do. I mean, they catch their prey by stealth, and, they reproduce and deposit eggs all over the place, and then we get more spiders. And eventually, everything winds up in one big web. So, it's an interesting thought that maybe this art form, as she calls it, is indicative of the fact that something, hopefully someone wants something to hatch, But they also should realize that there are products around like Raid, which can be used to curtail this type of activity. And I'm just hoping that people who are waking up are going to supply a countermeasure to this type of nonsense. But one thing that the young lady said, which I thought was interesting, was that she represents a group or is part of a group of average everyday citizens that are interested in prying into things. And, you know, we Americans and the Canadians have been buddy-buddy for a very, very long time. And interesting that she called from Ottawa. I mean, I've been there several times. I was involved at one point with an energy organization that wanted to do something constructive with the Canadian government, and we met in Ottawa, a beautiful city. But I think it's really interesting that that there's a group like that in existence. And that excited me much more than the spider did, to be honest with you. I think it would be really interesting if the average everyday folks started to coalesce and consider trying to expose and investigate things that are going on. Now, I say this for a very interesting reason. I once had a very dear friend named Mike Shields. Unfortunately, he passed away. But when I was living up in northern Michigan, he became very, very interested in the research I was doing on Otis Carr. And there was a time when I had written to a newspaper regarding one of the articles or part of an article that I managed to retrieve, and I wanted to know if they had more on that subject, and I also wanted to know who had submitted the information. And what was interesting was that they wrote back to me, and they gave me the name of this guy who had contributed to the article. And when I contacted this guy, it turned out he was a janitor. He had no information whatsoever about hard science. He had no real understanding even of the ramifications of what it would mean if Otis Carr's technology had been for real or was allowed to progress. But the interesting thing was that just because of who he was and the job that he did, he was in a position to find out a whole lot of interesting facts. And he put them all together into an article, which then became the nexus of this particular bit of journalism that interested me. So I guess my point is that, you know, the way our society is slanted, people get the impression quite often that if you're not a PhD, or if you're not a scientist, or if you're not a member of some university staff, that there isn't really very much that you can find out, there isn't very much that you contribute, but actually it's quite the opposite. The everyday people are in the position, you know, to totally dissect and assimilate all of the stuff that's going on into a coherent picture if they can overcome the stigma of working together. And that's why I thought it was very interesting what this lady said about this group. And I would like to know more about her group. I wish she'd call back.
Well, she mentioned Dr. Christopher Holmes. Now, he has been on this show. He is a forensic psychologist, and he's also a metaphysician. And he's got some really interesting takes on what's going on. Of course, I think he and I agree 100% about the sickness that the world's leadership is enduring right now and manifesting through their deeds. They're on a self-designed path to total destruction, and I think they're going to destroy themselves before they actually are able to destroy all that they wish to destroy. So,
well, I hope you're right, because we don't need their kind.
Yeah. But now, as far as the meaning of the spider.
Yes.
You know, the general nature of a black widow spider, the one that presents a danger to the human species or to animals, is the female. That's the one that has the hourglass on the underbelly, the red hourglass. And the female sometimes, after mating with the male, will eat the male. Not always, but in most cases, that will happen. So there's a symbology in there, one that actually has connections into black magic and voodoo. And I referred to Michelle Obama's dress in Chicago the night of the election when Obama went out and accepted the speech. You know, they've described this in fashion magazines and mainstream media, the black and red dress. You know, they don't see the hourglass that's on it. And it's done sort of subtly to affect the consciousness of people. But it's the honoring of the female energy and implying that the male will be disempowered. And the eggs, of course, are the result of that manifestation. In other words, they didn't have a male spider there. They just had the female spider guarding her eggs. And so there's a lot of symbology in that, but it's basically to create a different, a new balance, or somehow give the impression that the female is gaining power over the male. Yet don't be fooled by all the drugs that they're giving, especially these vaccines that have the power to sterilize both male and female. If you, and I'm presuming there wasn't a web there, if it was designed at all to represent the spider being in its home, the Black Widow web is one of the most neurotic webs that you'll ever see. It's very asymmetric. It would be like a civil engineer gone mad during the building of a bridge. And you have all these beams going in every direction imaginable and no path to drive. It's a very strong, I can only describe it as neurotic type of web. When you first lay eyes on a Black Widow web, you almost think that you're seeing fog or smoke because of how light strikes it, and it's usually in a dark corner or behind a piece of furniture or underneath something. The spiders themselves hide under rocks and under boards or tree limbs that have fallen. They're not really keen on loud, noisy places. Most spiders like to hide in the dark and hide somewhere where they can rest. The only time they're out and about is when they're hunting for food. So it is a very deadly bite. So there's a lot of meaning in there. And I would suspect that somehow the Vatican is behind this, as well as those that practice voodoo.
Well, what I was going to suggest, since they already have this organization that they're involved with, that they should find out the origins of this artwork. Who paid for it? Why is it there? Who made it? You know, who commissioned it to be made? Where did it come from? Where was it cast? Where was it, assembled? All that would probably shed light on a lot of things if, in fact, there's something strange or suspicious about the whole monument. I mean, that's something that's worthwhile. I mean, why would you put up such a thing anyway? You know, unless it was to attract attention or deliver a message. It's not the kind of thing that you would normally find, you know, as an art piece and, you know, placed deliberately for a public appreciation. You know, it just doesn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was conveying a message or making a statement, that's another story, and it deserves to be looked into.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of symbology there. There's almost a an astrological kind of symbology there too, in terms of the solstices and the equinoxes being divisible by eight, and the fact that the spider has eight legs, and I don't know how much it really warrants talking about it, but I'm trying to answer Noella's questions best I can, and you are. I guess we'll see, you know. We'll see. It certainly seems like a huge waste of money. Obviously, there's a subliminal message that they're trying to get across. And some people are questioning what it is. Other people are probably looking for their bug spray. Maybe they should erect a big, tall can in the vicinity of it.
Absolutely.
With a little spray nozzle and a little gray alien holding it, pointing it towards the spider. Well,
now, all these things, you know, are mysteries of their own. But like I said, if they have a group that's interested in investigating stuff, that's a perfectly good target for investigation, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I can do a little bit of research in that as well. You never know.
No, you come up with some amazing stuff, so it might be interesting.
Well, speaking of amazing stuff, we talked on last week's show about your Dynaflux generator, and I had some folks ask if you would describe the size. Well, it's an issue of the application, as you were describing last week, and I want to allow you the opportunity to tell people. Let's say, I think what people are thinking is, you know, how can they get off the grid, or if they get off the grid, how will one of these Dynaflux generators serve them at their home, or can several homes run power off of this? Those are the types of questions that people were asking.
Well, before we get into all of that, let me just backtrack a little bit. And for the sake of any other listeners, let me pick up exactly where we left off. You know, what I was doing when I first got the inspiration for this machine was I was working for Bethlehem Steel, and they had, I was in northern Michigan in a complex known as the Drummond Island facility, and they had a very large electric bill, certainly not as large as some place like Sparrows Point, but, I mean, it was a pretty big bill for the facility that they had on this island, which I might add was producing dolomite sintering material for the blast furnaces. And so, because I was the electrical supervisor for this island facility, it was often brought to my attention that there must be some way to lower the electric bill. Well, you know, I was pretty busy in those days doing all kinds of things for them, but I did take the time to do a power survey using the instruments in the main powerhouse. And, you know, it became very evident to me that the thing that was killing them the most was their demand. And they had three separate situations which would produce the most demand. One of them was boat loading, where they were loading the product onto the ore boats that would come by down from Lake Superior and come in to the channel right there where the St. Mary's River joins Lake Huron, and load up with this sintering sand. Another, or two others, were the actual electric digging machines that they had out in the quarry, which they used to load the shot rock onto these big trucks, where they would then transport that, I think it was like 5 miles or something from the quarry in the interior of the island to the plant where it was crushed and sorted.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, once I realized that it was a demand issue, I was starting to think about how I could counter the demand. Well, of course, you know, Bethlehem Steel and other big companies like that don't just bow to the whims of junior engineers who make proposals. And so, in a certain sense, it was very serendipitous that they decided to scrap their oldest electric shovel, which I believe was a Cyrus Erie, and it had within it a very large synchronous motor and a motor generator set that was used to power the digging machine. And so I went and pleaded on behalf of this Ward Leonard MG set to the head honcho there at the island and said, I would really appreciate it if you'd let me salvage the guts of this machine. You can scrap the rest of it if you want to, but I think I can turn this into something that would be very beneficial for decreasing your electric bill. And so they made me write a proposal and do a presentation and talk about what I had in mind, and I won them over. And it took me 3 years of my spare time to do this, and it turned out to be a success. I think the savings was almost 30% on the bill, which made everybody happy except the power company. And the reason I'm mentioning all this, even though we went through it last week, is because this machine that I revamped and built the facility around was a very sizable device. I mean, it weighed many, many tons, and it was big enough to fill the average living room with just a little walk-around space. So we're talking about something that was designed and engineered to offset the demand of a very large processing plant. Jumping forward in time, because there's no point in rehashing everything, when I discovered this Dynaflex concept and realized its value, I built a small tabletop prototype as the first machine, and then over the next several years there were at least 3 or 4 other prototypes slowly escalating in size. Now, they really don't have anything to do with one another in terms of what they, how they operate or what functions they provide. It was just that the completion and further examination of the behavior of the synchronous capacitor was probably responsible, at least in part, for the inspiration that I had regarding the Dynaflex concept and then the prototypes that followed afterwards. Now, in a sense that's similar to any little portable generator, you know, if you go to some of your larger supply houses, you can buy auxiliary generators made by companies like Honda and various other ones that range in size from something that you can carry around like a little briefcase just for running a few electric drills and a couple of lights, you know, all the way up to standby units which have to be towed by, you know, a pickup truck. And then, you know, when you go to places like hospitals and industries where they need standby power, now you're talking about considerably larger machines.
Mm-hmm.
So all generators, and motors too for that matter, can be scaled in size, you know, to any particular application or requirement. And this you know, the principles that are involved are used over and over again. It's just a question of how big do you want it, how much power do you want. Well, the same holds true for this Dynaflux concept. You know, theoretically, once the thing is finished being engineered and it can be commercialized, it can be also a small unit or a very large unit, depending on what people want. The thing that is interesting or exciting about the machine, which makes it stand apart from the more traditional devices of that sort, is not the fact that it develops an electrical output, but rather that the geometry that was utilized in its construction allows us to separate the motor characteristics of the generator from the generator characteristics of the generator. And that's something which traditional wisdom says is not possible. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why it has taken so long for any serious work to have been done on this subject, was because the minute that you approach that and try to explain to someone that this possibility exists, all of the eggheads and PhDs that are so entrenched in the current paradigm immediately respond with all this clamor about how that, if that were possible, it would be a violation of conservation of energy and this and that and the other thing. It turns out it isn't a violation of anything. And the real thing that's happening is a direct giveaway, you know, to the fact that that things are very different from the way we're told they are. And and so, you know, from that point, once you understand that, the interesting thing is that it opens the door to such a myriad of possibilities, not only in the power generation field, but with electric motors, with transformers, with control systems, with power transmission lines. I mean, it's just one thing after another. And it had been my hope, Don, that at one point we would get to a position where I could basically start to teach why this is possible, how it works, and actually encourage other people to go and investigate this stuff. The biggest problem I have in doing that right now is, you know, that the work I'm doing, which I have not talked about because of its legal restrictions at this point, is not all patented, and, you know, to make a general disclosure precludes patenting, and I don't want to get into that position, especially after having put so many years of work into understanding this.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say a few things that anybody that's really interested could certainly cue on and at least know where to focus. And if you want me to do that, I will.
Yes. Before you do, I have to try to segue back to the original topic we were on. After we moved on to this topic of the Dynaflux, we got another call from North Carolina. We have a good friend of my good friend, Drew Raines, on the line. Anzara, are you with us? Not hearing anything. Seth, is Anzara with us?
R-A. Anzara. Very easy.
Oh, Anzara.
I'm just hoping
okay.
that I'm not throwing this wonderful gentleman off, but I do want to thank you so very much, because in finding Drew Raines, we found you, and my husband listens every night, and I do until I fall asleep. But the point I want to make is, I'm a metaphysician, I'm a former Wiccan high priestess, and what you are saying has there's another concept. I don't know if this would relate or not, but you might consider it. Spiders are one of the natural vampires of nature,
mm-hmm.
if you've noticed what they do with their meals. They drain them of all liquids, fluids, etc. They're vampires in nature. And this relates to something else. And what it relates to is what is happening now. I have been a vampire fan since I was a teenager. But what is happening today is frightening. Because everyone out there, all the shows, down to the children and the teenagers with this new Moonlight deal, it seems that the powers that would like to be are trying to get people very, very accustomed to different, rather dark concepts, similar to the way they have desensitized people to violence. And now we have the vampires out there. And spiders are big vampires, or little ones. It depends on whichever way you look at it. Do you think that's viable?
Well, I'll say this. I know that the neurotoxins in any venom break down tissue. And
mm-hmm.
so they liquefy their victim. It's
mm-hmm.
not, whereas a vampire, or the concept of a vampire, is based on blood. And
right.
there's a lot of symbology in that as well. But,
it's a symbolological association I made.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that. What you're saying doesn't sound outlandish. Whether I subscribe to the fear that's intended is another issue.
Uh-huh.
Vampires are one topic. Spiders are a totally different one, found
right.
naturally in nature. And to try to tie the two together ritualistically, as they do, we could say that the vampire and the spider are symbolic of a reptilian.
I guess you know. They are.
All right. Jim, do you want to comment on that?
Connection.
Jim,
I would agree with you totally.
Yeah, Jim, do you want to comment?
Well, I'm in agreement in the sense that from the standpoint of functionality, they're essentially the same thing. I mean, when a vampire, you know, attacks its victim and drains its blood, it is ingesting tissue, because blood is tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just draining the life, you know, essentially with the blood.
The life force, yeah.
The only difference that the spider makes, really, is that usually his victims are other insects or small animals. And when he injects the venom into the victim, it dissolves the internal organs and all the soft parts, and essentially turns it into a soup. Well, once he has it, that soup, he can drink that up through his, you know, his mandibles or his little mouth apparatus, and the result is basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
So the symbology works. You know, I'm not aware of any other links that might be out there. But don't forget, these people concentrate on all this stuff. They focus on all of this black magic and all these other things that they're trying to use on a full-scale basis. And I try to focus on more constructive pursuits. But I would venture to say that if somebody was in the same category as the people who are responsible for these actions, that you would eventually come to a point where you understood, you know, what all these things mean. I'm sure they're tied together somehow.
Well, what concerns me, gentlemen, is the fact that the young people are becoming more and more desensitized to the darker aspects of the occult, which is one reason I have left Wicca, because it has been so bastardized by the powers that wish to be. And let me tell you, it is frightening to me what is happening between the sleeping and the influence out there. And this spider statue, that concerns me big time. Believe me, I just wanted to do that. I don't want to take up a lot more of your time or anything else, and I certainly thank you for taking my call.
Oh, I'm sorry you had to wait so long. We had shifted topic.
And, heavens above, he was talking about really important stuff, too. I mean, and God bless you, and wonderful, wonderful good luck with all your work and the future, sir. And please watch your back, as they say. Or what do they say? Keep standing vertical.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you for your call, and please call again. Very interesting comments.
All right. God bless you all, and thank you very much.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye. Jim, we've got another call. Now we've got Dr. Christopher Holmes on the line. Dr. Holmes, are you with us? Okay. I'm not hearing him. Seth, do we still have Dr. Holmes on the line?
Hello. Can you not hear me?
I can hear you now. Hello, how are you?
Okay, good. I heard Noella call in earlier about the Black Widow spider in Ottawa. It's this like 30-foot tall sculpture, and there's also a similar sculpture in the Rockefeller Center in New York City.
Why am
I
not
surprised? There
is
a similar Black Widow spider has just been constructed in the Financial District of London. And another Black Widow spider, similar sculpture, is at the World Court in The Hague. And my understanding of the Black Widow spider, there was such a sculpture in Nazi Germany, a massive sculpture, and it had seven pods off the main Black Widow spider. So that's part some of the background to Noella's comments about the Black Widow spider. And I've been writing a book. It's called O Canada Lost, The Ascendancy of the New World Psychiatric Disorder. And it's explaining kind of how the Rockefellers and the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergs, how these kind of secret societies kind of have taken over Canada. And the cover of this book, I went down and took photographs of this Black Widow spider framing the Houses of Parliament underneath the spider. So it's this massive Black Widow spider overpowering the Houses of Parliament in Canada. You can see the image on my website at zeropoint.ca. You can see the book cover of what I'm writing.
Now, do you have an actual picture of the statue? This is in Ottawa that it exists, or...?
Yeah, if you go to my website, you can see it. It's on the book cover there. It's a close-up of it. It's kind of an abstract. But, I have dozens of pictures of it. I can send you some of the pictures of the Ottawa one, and I have pictures of the Rockefeller Center, Black Widow, and another one from the Court of The Hague. I'll send them to you.
My goodness. As a psychologist, what do you see in all of this on a higher level, you know, or from a higher perspective, looking down upon it? What do you see?
It's just the web of conspiracy that these kind of lunatics have woven through history, and you know, it's satanic. It's, you know, I think it just depicts the kind of wickedness of the web of deceit that they spin, and kind of black magic symbol, and embodies their wickedness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But they're proud of it. I mean, they are literally, you know, constructing these monuments, or whatever you want to call them. They're indicative of their function. And the fact that there are several of them in key strategic places seems to indicate that, you know, it's almost like an advertisement. They're making a statement.
Yeah. It's funny.
Well, there are certainly some spiders that actually have a bite. You know, the Australian funnel web is supposed to be a pretty toxic kind of venom. But you see, it's not as black. It's actually usually a brown spider. And there are some bird spiders that from South America that are quite large and quite dangerous. But the little brown recluse, you know, an eighth to a quarter of an inch in size, can be more deadly than a black widow. But you see, it's not as impressive, or it's not as symbolic. And of course, they have to have their darkness, their blackness, and of course the red hourglass underneath symbolizes the blood. And my description, I don't know if you heard my description about the web. It's really something to behold. I mean, I've seen these massive amounts of black widow webs in people's garages when I lived in California. And they hide in every nook and cranny, every corner, like in the garage, for instance. And you would be surprised at the strength of the web. It doesn't look anything like a normal spider web. And yet, when you really see one, like at nighttime, when you take a flashlight and shine it on the web, you just look at it and you say, what was this thing smoking when it before it made this? It's chaotic is the best way I can describe it. And extremely sticky. I mean, a person's fingers can get caught in it, and it's very difficult to get it off your fingers. Not to mention, you know, if you get bitten by one and you're susceptible to the venom and you don't get first aid, you could get very sick. So
anyway, I'll let you and Jim go back to your conversations. I just wanted to fill in a little bit about the spider. Thanks, guys.
Okay, yeah, if you can email me a couple of photos, that'd be very kind of you to do that.
I'll do that.
Okay, goodbye. Thank you. All right. Well, there we go again. Now, maybe the Dynaflux is the answer to the Black Widow.
Well, anyway, I'm not sure how we're going to bounce back to that subject at this point. Where were we? I think that we were discussing the...
you were talking about the different models and
I went through the chain of events to bring us up to that point, and then I was trying to let them know that there are different sizes. It's no different than any other type of generator. But what makes it interesting is not the fact that it produces electricity, but the fact that it was designed to... separate, as I started to say, the motor characteristics of the generator from the generator itself. And people may not know what that means, but the reason why it takes so much horsepower to twist an electric machine and produce current out of it is because the physical arrangement of a motor and a generator, at least in the more simplistic arrangements, are almost identical. And so when you have one of these devices spinning and you're taking electric power out of it, because you've utilized the same geometry that would normally be used for an electric motor, what happens is that all the forces that an electric motor is noted for are also embodied in the generator. And essentially what happens is a torque is produced by the current passing through these magnetic fields, which attempts to rotate the generator as a motor. But due to this Lenz law, when you investigate it, you find out that the torque that's produced, if it was allowed to operate, would rotate the machine in the direction opposite to what you're attempting to spin it, to the sense that you're spinning it in, which would prevent further flow of current. And so the prime mover has to be powerful enough to literally twist this electric motor against the torque that it's producing and therefore sustain the voltage and current that's flowing in the external circuit. Now, the reason why this paradigm is so entrenched is because the belief is that it is, in fact, this Lenz reaction or this overcoming of back EMF, depending if, you know, which way you're going, which is responsible for the actual transformation of mechanical energy into electrical energy, or if you happen to be going the other way, electrical energy into mechanical energy. And all the equations that relate to this stuff are intermarried. And in fact, when the steam machines of the old days, turbines and reciprocating engines and such, were used to twist these generators, then you had thermodynamicists coming into the picture and saying, well, okay, we've got these heat engines here which produce so much horsepower on their output shafts, and we want to marry these things to electric generators. So it became very important to understand the physical relationships necessary to make a good engineering match. And so electrodynamics and thermodynamics wound up being married, and the equations interrelated. And the interesting thing is that it's the same law, this Lenz law, which allows those equations to be set equal to one another. Now, since this forms the entire, almost the entire basis of modern electrodynamics, at least in terms of rotational energy conversion, it's not something that once you've spent your 16 years studying all this stuff to get a degree or a PhD, that someone is going to be readily willing to say, oh, well, you know, there's an oversight, or, you know, certainly there's another paradigm that would negate this one or whatever. No, it doesn't work that way. The reaction is not logical. It is completely emotional. And I've come to the conclusion that once people have reached this particular plateau of achievement, their minds are no longer open. They just spend all of their energy defending their position, and they don't want a change in paradigm because they feel that that would mean that the investment that they made in time and money, you know, to get to where they are would be proven wrong. And I've actually had people tell me this. But I can't see it that way. I don't see that there would ever be any progress if that type of attitude prevailed. I mean, if I had a PhD, which I do not, and somebody came along and said to me, you know, you studied for X number of years to get this, and I'm here to tell you that even though you're an expert in this field, there's another way to do this, which may threaten the existing paradigm. Well, my reaction would be, so show me. Let's do it. I just can't understand the negative reactions that you get when you make these.
You know, those in law, those in certain aspects of business, in the insurance industry, and in some medical fields, are required to take continuing education courses to catch up to the new technologies, right? Or at least they tell the students that they're going to have to do that. And somehow they're exempt from these things. Science is a perfect example. Mainstream science, I'm talking about, and you very well know that. I'm preaching to the choir there. And anyone else who's a scientist who's listening that knows that there's a lot of suppression of the truth and a lot of lies and distortions and exaggerations take the place of the truth as to what's given to the public. We're told to cherish change, and yet it's built into us. It's designed through the mind control and the propaganda to make us resistant to change at the same time. So you have a dichotomy. You have this tug of war going on within the individual because the belief system is telling him he can change, and the lower consciousness, the everyday consciousness that's been reduced to this very low vibration, is saying, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm comfortable where things are. I don't want anything to change. You see, you people are not even paying attention to what's being said. And they're reacting accordingly. You know, they get the glassy eyes as soon as you mention this. Or the scientists become incensed and angry and disrespectful to you and your inventions and your discoveries, because it's beyond their understanding. They can't begin to understand it because it requires consciousness. And it requires a furthering of knowledge that they're not willing to admit is a possibility with them. Probably isn't. They prefer to remain ignorant and stupid and corrupt because it fits very well with their taskmaster's plan. So, my two cents.
Well, it's a fine observation. It's just a shame that it has to be that way. When I was a kid, I worshipped science, and my understanding of it was that essentially it was an unbiased, totally pure search for truth. And frankly, nothing could be further from the truth in that definition. And it took me a lot of years to find that out. But on the other hand, I must say that I have met an awful lot of people with all sorts of degrees who really can't uphold their own subject matter. And that, to me, is even harder to understand. You know, if you really love what you're doing, I mean, why would you ever stop pursuing an understanding of it, you know, to the nth degree? That's something I can't fathom at all. But apparently, that's exactly what happens. As a matter of fact, our society is so governed by things like the Peter Principle that it's a wonder it functions at all. You know, some of your brightest engineers accelerate up the ladder of progress with all of these promotions and whatnot, and they wind up in a position of management and planning where they never get to use any of their talents at all. And then, you know, the whole register beneath them is stacked with people that are also out of phase with what they're best suited to do. And as a result of that, you wind up with this incredible monument, which actually represents a social parallel to the spider web you were describing. It's like total chaos. But for some reason, everybody looks at it as if it's a hallowed organization that can't go wrong.
You know, one thing that came to mind while you were describing, you know, this whole process, both how your Dynaflux generator works and how a motor works what is available now in terms of the standard generator. And I was thinking to myself that you have something that belies this lie. Can you belie a lie? I guess you can. It debunks the lie that there's an energy crisis. First of all, you and I have discussed this. Energy is everywhere, and it's not going anywhere. It's not leaving. It's a question of harnessing it and putting it into productive power. in whatever form one chooses, and is appropriate. And yet they keep telling us there's an energy shortage, And the price you pay for the things that produce power is obscene. And that's what it's really all about, is hiding the truth about the nature of energy and its application for producing power. It's as simple as that. And you've talked about that before, but I'm bringing that up for those that may have just heard this for the first time and are paying attention, because that's a ruse. It's as much a ruse as the swine flu and the bird flu and SARS and AIDS. And not that people don't get these things. If they get vaccinations, they get the disease. Or the ruse about the economy, or the ruse about health care, and any number of issues. It doesn't matter. They've created a false paradigm for every problem that we have, and people are focusing on the bait that's been put out in front of them. You know, it's literally a worm on a hook, and people don't stop to think, wait a minute, I don't eat worms. So, you know, we just don't pay attention.
Well, not only that, the thing that's interesting, too, about this whole business of energy, I've said this a million times, I'll say it again, energy doesn't do anything for you in the first place. The most useful function that energy has, believe it or not, is in accounting. Because energy takes the time out of a process, which is normally represented by a function we call power. And when you take the time out of it, it allows you to quantify it in a particular instant so that you can make comparisons with other things. So, for instance, I have so many kilowatt hours being delivered to this factory over here. And 25 miles away, I have a generating plant which is producing the power which is being delivered to that plant. That generating station is consuming coal or oil or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the oil or the coal can be looked upon as potential energy expressed in BTUs.
Yeah.
And so it allows them, the bean counters, to say, okay, we can, if we know how much coal it takes at this end to deliver so many kilowatt hours at that end, we are now in a position to calculate our profit margin. But this is why there's such a preoccupation with this word energy. But I think there's a more sinister sub-level to this reasoning, and that is that as long as you concentrate on energy, you'll never understand the wonderful things that Tesla was trying to do with power. Now, people get all ticked off when you tell them stuff like this, and they go, what are you talking about? You know, power is nothing more than, you know, a flow of energy. Well, in a sense, that's true. But why it's so different is because if you look at energy mathematically, whether it's the energy of something that's stationary or a potential of some sort, or whether it's energy represented by angular momentum or linear velocity of a mass, you will eventually understand, if you really look into it, that both of those things are forms of potential energy. You can't do anything with either of those situations until there's a change of state. And that change of state is represented by an acceleration. And as soon as there's an acceleration involved, if you do the dimensional analysis associated with that equation, you'll find that that's the only time that work is done per unit time. And that, in turn, supports the definition of power, not energy. Now, of course, once you reach that position of your thinking, you start to wonder, or at least I did, whether or not it's possible to have a magnification or a change, let's use that word, a change in power, in available power, without affecting so-called energy. And once you start thinking in that direction, that's what leads you to investigate some very strange phenomena. And Tesla went there, and it took me years to understand what he was talking about. I tried to follow in his footsteps. And I may not ever amount to something like Tesla amounted to, but the interesting thing is that my efforts indicate, at least to me, that there is a doorway to a higher octave of understanding that comes from walking in that direction. And a lot of people should make the trip, not just one or two, because it results in a totally new understanding of what it is that confines us to our present paradigm, and also points the way to the real way in which nature functions. And unfortunately, it's been an uphill battle, you know, for many, many years in this direction. But that doesn't mean that it's a futile battle. I mean, if I had known when I was 19 what I know now, it would certainly be an exciting situation. But one good thing I can say is that this knowledge has been hard won. Nobody handed it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if the day ever comes when I'm in the position to share it, I think people will be pretty astounded at what it all implies.
Mm-hmm. Jim, in past shows, even last week, and you sort of alluded to it at the beginning of your explanation when you mentioned kilowatt hours, the powers that be tell us that they're delivering energy to us.
They are.
In reality, creating the power, or they're producing the power, which is what's being delivered to us. And your invention basically liberates the use of power and the application of energy from that matrix, and frees it from the restrictions of time. Would that be accurate in saying it that way?
Well, a better way to say it would probably be this. They transmit power and bill you for energy. And
okay.
the reason why that is interesting is because if the next step was taken where we move into the realm of power oscillation. Okay, now you've got power moving in two directions instead of one. And when you do that, that's really the next step to understanding what Tesla was talking about with energy resonance and all this other stuff. Because what happens is you wind up with a situation where you have a restorative watt. And, I mean, the physics behind this stuff is not simple. And most people haven't the vaguest idea what you're talking about, even when you show it to them. But the fact of the matter is, if power were allowed to flow in two directions, if they left their present metering intact and it wasn't detented, the effect would be such an enormous reduction in your bill every month that they just couldn't survive. But the interesting thing is it would also affect them at the generating end in a very profitable manner. because when the tower reverses its direction, if the plant was set up to receive that reflected power coming back, the result would be that the torque requirement to turn that generator, which is as big as a house or a locomotive or whatever, would go down dramatically. And therefore, their overhead and fuel would go down. But the fact that they prefer to send you something which is non-returnable and then bill you for the time integral of that quantity is what allows them to set the situation up the way they've got it. And sooner or later, that's gonna change because they can't even sustain it. You know, there's not enough burnable fuel on the planet at the rate at which we're growing to allow this existing power paradigm to continue. And the interesting thing is that the next octave of expression of that is a natural thing if it was only allowed to be followed up upon. But
yeah. So
they don't do it.
So the biggest enemy of this progress, this technical progress and scientific progress, is greed.
Always has been.
Pure and simple.
Yeah, always has been.
Well, hopefully we answered some of the questions that folks had. And, you know, I've referred on past shows to the demonstration that I witnessed of two or three of these Dynaflux generators. And I recall you taking the people that were interested in looking at this technology, which was all captured in the video, into a lab where you had one set up without a load on it. And you had remarked that you couldn't leave it on for very long because there was no load attached, and the thing had a tendency to take off and fly across the room. Now, that's not a negative. It's just a very dramatic way of describing what happens, how much power is produced.
Well, the reason is really quite simple to understand. It's because when you have this bidirectional movement of power, and you have a machine that's built to capitalize on that particular aspect of electromechanics, or whatever you want to call this subject, electrodynamics, if you then interrupt that cycle, what happens is that the machine automatically seeks another level of equilibrium, mm-hmm. and it'll run away in order to try and find it. And if it's a large enough machine, it will accumulate so much kinetic energy in the process that it could theoretically destroy itself. A very good example of that is on a bench that I have set up in the lab there, we have a standard generator and the Dynaflux generator, both being run off the same motor with a clutching arrangement so that you can select where the mechanical power flows. It'll either go into a standard machine or a Dynaflux machine. And if you take an ordinary generator and you bring that up to speed, you know, throw power into the magnetic field, and then you literally short-circuit the output, the torque becomes so great in such an instantaneous fashion that the coupling between the motor and the generator can literally explode. This is one of the reasons why they have reverse power relays in power plants, is to prevent accidents like that, because imagine that happening on something that's producing, you know, 100 megawatts. The result would be catastrophic. So anyway, on this short, on this small setup, if you short the leads on the standard machine, it'll come to a screeching halt. But if the power was turned up high enough, the forces would be so astronomical that the coupling would just explode. Well, the interesting thing is, if you did the same exact thing to the machine sitting next to it, what happens is very interesting. It just says, oh, no load? Well, there must be another equilibrium point somewhere, so it just speeds up. And the reason it's speeding up is because its internal power isn't being used for anything external. And so when it oscillates and gives back to the prime mover, it's helping itself to turn.
Mm-hmm.
So that has to go somewhere. And so it starts to rev up, and that energy that's associated with that process winds up being stored in the momentum of the rotor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the machines that I have, that doesn't go on forever. What happens is that ultimately the wire that you're shorting and the coils in the generator provide enough braking action, so that when it does speed up to some level and the current goes up high enough, you wind up with a new top speed, you might say, and the conversion is being done in the wiring. So it'll sit there and heat up. Everything will just heat up. But if you do that at the design load of the machine, then it just supplies you with the same characteristic power transfer that you would expect from any machine, and it just sits there and runs. But under those conditions, the amount of power that it takes to turn it is significantly less than what it takes to turn the machine of the standard design.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the benefit lies.
Yeah. I recall your original setup where you had a standard generator with a motor, which is the load, and you had an external light bulb attached to it. And you explained the output capacity of the motor and the generator in concert, and there was actually less than 100%. There is some energy that's lost, but the light bulb did not light up. And yet you were able to take the same load and put that on your Dynaflux and light up the light bulb and then measure the amount of power that was not being used, which far exceeded the capacity of the other generator. Even though, in a sense, they're in the same league. Am I describing it right?
Yeah, what you're referencing there is this research machine that I built to further investigate this whole power oscillation phenomenon, and we refer to it as a transforming generator because it has characteristics of both a transformer and a generator built into one machine.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it's important is because it automatically adjusts its source impedance to the applied load so that it's always producing conjugate impedance automatically without regulation.
Yeah.
And the reason why that's important is because, as you rightfully stated, when you apply that to a load, it basically teaches you the difference, I mean, providing you're looking for it, between EMF, true EMF, which is emotional electric field, and voltage. They're entirely different animals.
Yeah.
They can be equated to one another, but that doesn't make them be the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's a very important distinction. And so that experiment you were describing, what actually happens is that when you get rid of the back EMF, what happens is that all of a sudden the voltage goes to a maximum, whereas previously only the EMF had been a maximum. And the experiment is designed to show that even though you have a maximum induced EMF, you can't necessarily do all of the work with it that you would like to see, because it's being consumed by impedances. But when you produce the mirror image of that situation, it almost goes into a mode of I won't call it superconductivity, but let's say enormously improved conductivity, which allows the electrical forces in the machine to produce their best results. And the reason I built that thing was because I wanted to understand more completely, you know, the reason why Dynaflux does what it does, and also to eventually improve its design to the point where it would meet with commercialization. The problem is that everything is custom. I got to design everything, have everything built from scratch, and it costs a bloody fortune. So it's taken a long time and a lot of money to understand some of this stuff.
Well, it's fascinating, and it's certainly, I see the application, as you well pointed out, in many areas, not just in powering one's home. It can be adapted to all types of transportation, manufacturing of products. And when we say transportation, we're not just talking about people transportation. We're talking about transportation of goods, shipping, and delivery systems. It's a shame that we listen to this dog and pony show all the time. You know, it's like listening to an out-of-tune banjo and somebody telling you that's a finely tuned harp. The stories that we get. We're out of time, and I want to thank you for your contribution to tonight's show. Definitely we hit some nerves tonight. People responded to these topics, and we actually had Noella start this off with the spiders. I was unaware that was going on, but it's not surprising. They put their symbology all over the place. What I think is interesting about that whole concept of the Black Widow spider and where these things are appearing, be interesting to see if there's one in China, because as I understand it, the Chinese are lobbying for a new, should we call it Federal Reserve or World Bank, something in the order of a Federal Reserve in Laos, and probably Hong Kong will become the new financial center of the world, even superseding the city of London. So this may be a last-ditch attempt amongst the Illuminati families to try to psych each other out. Certainly the Rockefellers. If you've got one of these outside, imagine what they have in their homes. You know?
I'd rather not think about it.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you, and I wish you a great weekend, and I look forward to next week.
Very good, Don. I'll be available as usual, and we'll try to explore this and other topics together.
Okay. All right. You have a great weekend. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com, and our special guest, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, Jim Murray. Now you see why he's our resident science advisor. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network for carrying this show. Give a shout out to all the members of the U.S. military around the world that are listening in. as well as blogtalkradio.com. Also, want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, all of our callers tonight, and most of all, everyone else in the listening audience for tuning in. I wish everyone a great weekend. Join us next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. A. Truat. In the meantime, have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.